Good afternoon, and welcome to this webinar, Safety Reborn, How Digital Transformation Can Preserve Our New Momentum. This event, brought to you by ISHN, is sponsored by Quarity. I'm your moderator, Benita Mehta, Chief Editor of ISHN. Thanks for joining us today. Today's presenter is Sean Baldry. Sean is a Product Marketing Manager responsible for Quarity's health and safety solutions. Sean has over 15 years of experience working in occupational health and safety in the construction, mining, and manufacturing industries. Prior to joining Quarity, Sean was the Director of Health and Safety for LafargeHolcim's Eastern Canada Division. Sean is a Canadian Registered Safety Professional, CRSP. Don't forget to submit your questions, and later in the program, our presenter will address as many as possible. Today's event is being recorded and archived on www.ishn.com. And now I'm excited to turn it over to today's presenter, Sean Baldry.
Well, thanks, Benita, and good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. So if you have a bit of time, I'd strongly recommend that you check out an excellent podcast called Cautionary Tales that's moderated by Tim Harford. And recently I came across an episode of the podcast that was entitled That Turn to Pascagoula, which I'd like to summarize for you to start off today, because I think it contains some interesting insights into how we how our view of safety may be changing as a result of COVID-19. So the podcast told a story about how, starting in the late 1990s, risk management experts were raising warnings about southern Louisiana's vulnerability to a major hurricane. And these experts were sharing models that appeared to suggest that a direct hit from a major hurricane would likely breach the levees in and around New Orleans, flood the city's low-lying areas, trap, you know, upwards of a quarter of a million people, and likely and unfortunately result in the deaths of tens of thousands. And, you know, these experts were even questioning whether the local and state governments even had the capacity to evacuate people or even shelter the people that were unable to evacuate. And, you know, so when Hurricane Ivan came hurtling toward the city in September of 2000, and now you would think in this case that, you know, government officials would have acknowledged that they had been lucky to avert this catastrophe, and they would have started to address some of those major vulnerabilities in emergency management that had been identified, but they didn't. And we know they didn't, because when the next hurricane hit a year later, we know that the city and the residents weren't as lucky. So, you know, why didn't the authorities react to these known vulnerabilities after Hurricane Ivan and before Hurricane Katrina? Well, you know, these experts were arguing that it's due to something called the availability bias. So availability bias is a tendency to think of events that are easily recalled from memory as being most likely or more likely to occur or even more representative than what they actually are. And there's also a flip side to that. It also means that it's less easy as it is to recall specific events, it alters our perception about the probability that those events will actually occur. So let me explain this a little bit. Think of it this way. Imagine your house is situated on a floodplain. And now following a storm, let's imagine that your basement flooded. Your perception then of the potential for flooding after that major rain event or any major rain event is going to increase. And your behavior is going to change as a result. You're probably going to take, you know, more steps to do things to limit the impact of that flooding. You're going to sandbag your house. You're going to move things from low-lying areas, et cetera. But, you know, if you were fortunate enough to avoid flooding, you'd probably perceive that you had much lower chance of your basement flooding in the next rain event, even though you're still situated on the same floodplain, right? And it's this availability bias that operates on this notion that something that can be recalled easily must be important and therefore must be more important than competing issues. But as a result, people tend to weigh judgments more heavily on recent information, and they bias their opinions on those recent events. And alternatively, they pay less attention to events that aren't as front of mind, though they could arguably be as important. So you're probably asking yourself, you know, what does this have to do with health and safety? Well, I think it's fair to say that COVID-19 has undoubtedly had a significant impact on our perceptions about health and safety, and, you know, certainly health and safety at work. I know I can't think of a time in recent memory where the connection between managing risk and long-term business viability has been this clear. For me, it's literally the ability to keep people healthy and safe at work that in a lot of cases is going to determine whether a business survives. And, you know, we've seen this perspective translate into a lot of encouraging changes in the workplace. You know, we're seeing organizations pay more attention to emergency preparedness and resilience, you know, a risk analysis about health and wellness, particularly as it relates to mental wellness. And, you know, these are things that health and safety professionals have been fighting for years. So, you know, seeing these things kind of gives a sense that safety's been reborn. It's this new view of the profession. And yet, you know, despite these positive signs, there appears to be a growing worry about, you know, around health and safety professionals that, you know, once the current pandemic comes under better control, there's a risk or there's a fear that, you know, this new focus on safety will start to disappear with the virus, you know, potentially, you know, the effect of availability bias. So, you know, that presents a fundamental question for health and safety professionals, and that's how can we capitalize on this new health and safety focus right now to secure the investment right now that we need that's going to be necessary to have and to achieve safety success in the future? And that's really what I'd like to discuss today. So I thought we could break down our conversation into three parts. We'll start by exploring what health and safety trends and challenges have emerged, during COVID-19. You know, next, I'm going to argue that technology has been and will continue to be critical to address these challenges. And, you know, as a result of that, now is the time that health and safety professionals should be advocating for an investment to support a digital transformation in their health and safety programs. And lastly, we'll end our presentation by just reviewing some of the things that EHS leaders can do to build that compelling business case for that technology investment moving forward. So let's start our conversation by exploring how COVID-19 has shifted perspectives on occupational health and safety. You know, what trends or challenges have we seen emerge throughout the pandemic, and what might this mean for, you know, how we need to approach safety management moving forward in order to sustain the gains that we've seen? And for the sake of brevity, I'm going to narrow our conversation to three key trends that I see that I think are really key and may fundamentally change how we approach safety going forward. So the first concerns the increased focus on organizational resilience and business continuity, and I think everybody can probably guess that one. The second has to do with the rapid shift toward virtual workplaces and really what this means for managing on-the-job risks. And the third is the renewed focus around employee engagement and what it really means about the value of collaboration in terms of addressing some of those critical health and safety issues at the workplace. So let's take a few minutes and we'll unpack each one of these elements and really understand what we're talking about. So starting with organizational resilience, I think understandably there's been a huge focus on organizational resilience, you know, emerging out of the pandemic, this idea of the ability to withstand and recover quickly from business interruptions and emergency situations. And, you know, I would even argue that a positive effect of the pandemic has been it's helped organizations expose some of their critical gaps in business continuity planning that in turn gives them a chance to rethink how to build greater flexibility and adaptability in their processes. So, you know, they're able to withstand those shocks to the system without it collapsing or without it resulting in, you know, some pretty substantial business interruptions. And I think specifically the things that under the frame of organizational resilience that really jump out to me, there was one or the first concern, skill redundancy. So very quickly at the outset, many organizations were, you know, found that they were unable to sustain their essential business operations because the people in those critical roles or with those critical skills were unable to work either because of illness or because of the need to self-isolate. So, you know, these businesses soon realized that they needed to upskill their workforce. They needed to be able to build enough skill redundancy that would enable them to shift their available workers around in such a way that they can maintain those critical operations. And I think in a lot of ways, organizations found that they didn't have the capacity to do that in the way that they were currently structured. The second key item that was revealed under organizational resilience was this idea of adaptable workplace design. So as we can imagine, and I'm sure that many of you have seen this, many organizations were forced to quickly redesign their workplaces to accommodate social distancing guidelines when they started to reopen the economy earlier this year. And this created some pretty considerable challenges for a lot of businesses, specifically those where their workplaces were initially designed around this idea of density, right? So I'm thinking of assembly line work where people are packed very tightly together. That becomes very challenging in terms of adaptability of trying to change your workplace to manage social distancing when it's really not inherently designed that way. And I think what that's highlighted is that moving forward, organizations are going to need to consider how to design their workplaces in a way that maximizes adaptability. You know, how can they allow their operations to scale up or down depending on their available workforce without it resulting in these long-term significant business interruptions? And if that's not possible, you know, these firms are going to have to figure out ways to design their workplaces in a way that minimizes person-to-person contact from the outset. So in the event that there was an emergency or any sort of pandemic disease, they would be able to operate without a full complement of their workforce. So, you know, I think the pandemic will have a rather significant impact on how businesses design their operations, but also how they need to consider how changes to their operations, how they have to put that through that filter of organizational resilience, understanding what we've learned over the past few months. The second key trend that we're seeing is the shift toward virtual workplaces. So, you know, when the economy entered lockdown, I think we can probably all agree that one of the first steps that many businesses took to ensure business continuity was to assess what functions could be performed remotely. And while many firms, you know, certainly foresaw or believed that this was going to be something temporary, I think we're seeing now more organizations exploring long-term or even permanent shifts toward remote work. I know PwC released a report recently where they cited 74% of CFOs that they had surveyed now intend to allow the workforce to work remotely on a permanent basis. And if you've been watching the news, you've seen, you know, organizations like Amazon, MasterCard, Microsoft, they're all adopting more of a permanent or certainly a long-term shift toward remote work. But I think what we need to be mindful of is this shift toward remote work will change the nature, what I would call the risk profile of these remote workers, in a way that organizations are going to need to have to figure out how to mitigate these risks without having direct control or oversight of the workplace. You know, for instance, there was a study released recently by Chubb, and in that study, they had revealed that 41% of workers that were working remotely were now experiencing more back, neck, and shoulder pain when working from home than when they were working in the office originally. And similarly, almost 40% of these same workers reported that they were now working longer hours at home than they were typically at the office, and that was creating concerns around, you know, stress levels and risks around burnout. And these mental, you know, wellness concerns are certainly weighing heavily on a lot of businesses. There was a study published recently that had mentioned that 30% of the respondents had indicated that their mental wellness was actually a barrier to their productivity. So, you know, and that was a lot of that was associated with anxiety that was related to the social isolation that goes up, you know, with working from home or working virtually. So organizations are going to have to figure out how to respond to these emerging risks, you know, in a way that allows them to sustain, you know, their safety performance in the way that they want to go moving forward. And lastly, I'll say the third key trend that I see arising out of the pandemic concerns this focus around employee engagement. And it's interesting, Gallup administers a social services work and education poll every year through which it tries to assess overall job satisfaction of U.S. workers. And in this year's poll, Gallup reported that only about 65% of U.S. workers indicated that they were satisfied with their physical safety on the job. And what's pertinent here is that that's the lowest score in the last 20 years of this survey being administered. So while the result of the survey isn't unsurprising given the context of COVID-19, I think it might reflect perceptions amongst workers, you know, concerning the degree to which they feel that they have been and are continuing to be included in decisions on how the business will manage risk in the workplace and how to keep them safe on the job. You know, we all know that employees who feel that they're able to actively participate in safety decisions and to share their opinions are more likely to feel that any resulting rules or policies that are enacted are more fair. They're more likely to follow those rules and they're more likely to encourage their coworkers to do so as well. And, you know, we certainly have heard stories in the news about workers filing lawsuits against their employers for failing to take adequate precautions with the virus. And this, in my mind, may indicate that efforts to engage and involve employees in managing risk really haven't been optimized, because at the same time, we've also seen a number of workplaces that, you know, that have managed the reopening quite effectively. And within those, when you tease out some of the learnings from those examples, you see a lot of evidence of very strong employee engagement. You see examples of frontline employees being included in cross-functional teams that work together to develop protocols to manage some of these response plans, to work together to monitor compliance to a lot of the protocols that they set, and just generally the perception amongst the workforce that they feel that their organization is really caring about their health and safety. So, you know, what do these trends have to do with health and safety planning and budget? So to answer this question, I looked at a couple surveys, and as you would imagine, a lot of the surveys were revealing that while we had significant cost reductions in other areas of the business, it didn't appear as if budgets for safety were actually being cut to the same extent. In some cases, they were maintained at the same level, and in some cases, they grew with obvious increased expenditures around PPE and cleaning services and some of the immediate actions that were necessary to implement the physical distancing guidelines that public health authorities want businesses to put in place. But what's most interesting for me is how COVID-19 is impacting decisions on future health and safety budgeting. So in June of this year, PwC asked organizations to comment on what factors were driving their technology investment decisions over the next 12 months. And while a majority of firms had indicated that things like growth and cost reduction were continuing to drive a majority of their investments in technology spend, the survey revealed that businesses were planning to invest more in health and safety over the next 12 months, which is probably, obvious if you think about it, but it does represent potentially a shift in the way that organizations are approaching safety, which is certainly encouraging. So, with businesses announcing, this increased appetite to invest in technology for safety, it would be useful for us to explore how organizations may be able to utilize this technology or software solutions to address some of these key trends that we just talked about. So what I'd like to do now is just, I'm going to shift focus a little bit, and I'm going to narrow the conversation down to five key areas where we at Cordy specifically, see the opportunity for organizations to really leverage technology, really leverage software solutions to really enable them to sustain that momentum going forward and really ensure that they're positioned well to have sustainable safety performance and safety excellence in the future. So the first area that we see this opportunity has to do with the data visibility. So when the economy started reopening earlier this year, businesses were advised, and you probably, your businesses were probably the same, were advised to conduct employee screening as a way of ensuring that sick workers didn't enter the workforce and contribute to another workforce outbreak. And as a result of that, you likely, it may have been your workplaces or workplaces you've seen in your community, you may have seen images like the one that I'm showing on the screen on the left, with individuals lining up in a tent outside of their workplace, answering certain screening questions, having their temperatures checked before they were permitted to enter. And in many of these scenarios, the screening was collected either on spreadsheets or on paper, at a local operation, and then collated and forwarded to a corporate office. And then that's really where problems started to emerge. And this is what we had heard from a lot of the businesses that we've been talking to. It was at these corporate offices where, they were forced to take all this data from all these multiple locations and try to aggregate it and analyze it to be able to provide their leadership with enough meaningful insights that would allow them to assess either the efficacy of what they were doing or whether there were any emerging threats that needed senior level decision making. And as you can imagine, with less staff available, that ability to assimilate and analyze that data fast enough to be able to create those insights to enable that fast decision making really came under a lot of scrutiny. And I think this is, you know, this example really highlights that critical challenges that a lot of organizations are facing. And that's, you know, to start, businesses are collecting more data than they ever had at any point in human history. I read recently that there was an estimate that by the end of this year, businesses around the world will have collected 40,000 exabytes of data. So if you don't know what an exabyte is, think of a number and then put 18 zeros behind it. So that's an exabyte. So 40,000 exabytes, an absolutely massive number. And yet, despite this increased volume and velocity of data that businesses are collecting every single day, many organizations still lack that scalable capacity to be able to analyze that data and translate it into those meaningful insights fast enough to respond to the need for that quick decision making to run the business and certainly create the resilience that businesses are looking for. So, you know, it's for this reason that a lot of organizations will continue to shift toward software solutions, really to leverage that advanced analytics capability with things like AI and with machine learning and predictive analytics, so they can start to shift from more of a diagnose and treat mentality to more of a predict and prevent mentality, where they can use data models to predict certain emerging threats. They can use some of the analytic features to highlight some prescriptive insights that would help educate them on what they can do to prevent that risk, you know, to mitigate that risk and obviously keep people safe at work. So we certainly see a lot of growth in data visibility and data analytics coming forward, which is something that organizations really should be thinking about. You know, earlier we also mentioned this idea of shifting, the workforce shifting to remote work. And you know, I think it's important here to acknowledge that this will likely introduce what I call a new risk profile for workers. You know, employees that now work from home in improperly designed workstations will be exposed to more ergonomic risk. Those that are working in isolation and don't have a lot of social contact, that's where the concern is growing around mental health risks for employees. And since employers don't have direct control or oversight of these workplaces, they really need to find those innovative ways that they can help their employees self-assess those risks and then offer workers options to be able to self-manage those risks with, you know, self-directed and tools that are available to them, those employees where they are. So just as an example, on the left side of the screen, I've put an image of a solution that we have here at Cordy called OES. And really what it is, it's a solution where a user that is working in an office environment, whether, you know, in a proper office or at home, we give them the tools so they can self-assess their ergonomic risk and ergonomic setup at their workstation, and then give them some recommendations on things that they can do to manage and mitigate those risks without it relying on a more specialist intervention at the employer level. So if you think about you know, some of the needs that organizations and remote workers are going to need moving forward, it's these kind of solutions that are probably going to, there's probably a lot of opportunity there for organizations to look at. Similarly, on the right side of the screen, I've provided a graphic of a tool that's been developed by a company called Highmark Interactive, which is a company that we're working with currently here at Cordy, as an example of some of the things that are emerging on a mental wellness perspective. So in this application, it's a game-based mobile application. It allows users to play mini games on their mobile phone or their mobile device. And in the process of doing so, it provides a medical wellness evaluation. And what's interesting about this is in doing so, it will alert that individual in real time of some emerging trends that have to do with their mental health and resiliency, and then in turn can link or direct that worker to any available resources, whether it be virtual or whether it be anything that the employer currently has, such as an employee assistance program, to be able to link that individual to those appropriate healthcare services if they need it to address any sort of mental wellness issues that might come up. earlier, I had also mentioned that, you know, when we talked about organizational resilience, we talked about this idea of gaps in skill redundancy, which were causing a lot of challenges amongst workplaces in order to maintain those essential operations when they had, you know, a large degree of variability in terms of workforce availability. So, you know, this is where certainly with that shift to remote work, but also considering that social distancing restrictions are going to limit opportunities, you know, at least in the near term, but potentially in the long term, to conduct what we would call traditional in-person facilitated training, employers are going to have to be creative in how are they going to be able to fill those skill needs and competency needs that their workforce will require to be able to build that resiliency, but just generally to ensure that people can perform their job safely. And this is where we see that explosion in a lot of online and digital learning resources. It was growing at an extremely quick pace prior to the pandemic, and every indication would suggest that that's going to continue into the future, certainly considering those limitations in social distancing, but also considering that, you know, the younger workforce, younger workers that are entering the workforce certainly are much more inclined to this kind of you know, self-directed DIY style of learning. So certainly any of these digital applications where not only can we assign and track training completion, but we can offer a medium where people can either curate and or download content on any device that they want to consume it when it's available to them. That's certainly going to be something that we foresee growing in the near term, certainly accelerated as a result of the pandemic. One last thing I would say about learning and development, as you see with the image on the right side of the screen, there will also be, we're foreseeing a considerable interest in augmented reality kind of assisted training or learning. This is where an individual might don an AR-assisted headset, and before completing an activity, they can watch a video on the headset, start to complete the activity, and if they run into problems, they would have access through the headset to any remote resource which could actually help troubleshoot and walk them through. So again, we're able to provide that flexibility, that adaptability in that workplace that doesn't necessarily require multiple individuals to be together to have that peer-to-peer knowledge transfer. And essentially, we're providing options that we can shift that to more of a virtual environment, be able to maintain social distancing requirements, but still enable learning to continue as we know it needs to. You know, earlier when we talked about organizational resilience, we talked about this need for businesses to think about how they design their workplaces in a sense to be adaptable. And, you know, I think this is pretty, this thought is starting to be, you know, pretty eye-opening for a lot of businesses. And it certainly broadened a lot of the discussion around how businesses might be able to leverage technology to increase that adaptability. And I always like to use this analogy of the smart factory. So the smart factory is where we're leveraging technology to automate more of our traditionally human-centric processes, not only to have increased reliability, but in the case of COVID-19, it doesn't necessarily require people to be together. So we're able to manage social distancing requirements, but still achieve the efficiency gains that we're looking for. So just some examples of some of the things that I see being discussed openly right now. The first is looking at those IoT or Internet of Things devices. So these are your connected devices, your direct monitoring sensors, you know, adapting those and integrating those with your critical equipment to monitor equipment performance and monitor and improve your failure prediction. That's going to eliminate a lot of that unnecessary downtime and those work repairs that might require individuals to come together. So how can we leverage some of these connected devices to be able to increase our predictive view of what's going on in our workplace and to react preventatively before things break down and we need actual individuals to go out and touch equipment? The second example, and we kind of harken back to this idea of augmented reality. Again, it's leveraging these augmented reality devices, both for troubleshooting equipment, as we discussed previously, but also this idea, and I've seen this recently, a lot of discussion around virtual auditing. So this is where an individual would wear a headset and would be connected to a network of virtual auditors that would be in offices or other locations. That person would walk around. So obviously we're maintaining social distancing, but the virtual auditors would still have a view of the workplace, and there would still be that that cross-functional exchange that would be necessary to really derive a lot of value out of our health and safety auditing. And finally, as you guys are probably well aware of, a lot of interest now in wearables, especially connected to geolocation capabilities, which means that we can track the movement of certain individuals in a workplace, especially when they cross certain barriers, which is going to be particularly important to control infection risk or any sort of post-exposure contact tracing. The important thing, but before I leave this point, the important thing to remember here is these are all great solutions, but really the advantages that are offered through these IoT devices is really based on, or it's really predicated on this idea of having a robust platform that is able to take the outputs of these devices, be able to put it into the platform in a meaningful way, and then associate that with the workflows that are necessary to really drive performance. So IoT devices are certainly good things to look at, and we should be thinking about them for adaptable workplace design, but really they really need that broader EHS platform that's going to allow you to bring all those different data inputs together and create that holistic 360-degree view of risk. That's really going to be important to obviously reduce loss and increase organizational resilience. And as a last point, just this idea of optimizing engagement, the way that work is going to evolve now and into the future is obviously going to make the need for mobile solutions that much more prescient. You know, we're likely going to see fewer person-to-person interactions, I should say, more self-directed work, and just greater challenges in communicating across time and space. So when you consider, you know, frontline employees needing tools to be able to access data in the field to plan and execute work or to communicate concerns, that they're going to need tools in order to do that, especially if there's limitations in terms of the amount of in-person, person-to-person contact that they can have. Supervisors may need tools to enable them to review risk assessments, authorize permits, look at any sort of other, you know, assigned tasks to workers, again, crossing shifts or when they don't have that same person-to-person contact because of some social distancing requirements. And generally for senior leaders throughout the organization, we're probably going to see a pretty substantial shift in either the availability or comfort in bringing people together in a room, a conference room, a lunch room, to have a conversation with them and share information and solicit feedback. And certainly mobile-enabled tools are certainly going to be an advantage in that case to really support that communication and make sure that information is flowing that we know is necessary for safety performance. So now, you know, that we've explored, you know, how technology is certainly supporting a lot of these trends and a lot of these challenges that we're seeing, I just wanted to take the final few minutes that I have to explore how EHS professionals can build a compelling business case to convince the leadership within their organizations that this is something that we should be considering now and really investing in now so we can have obviously good and sustainable performance going forward. So I think as a first step, what you would want to do before taking any further steps is identify your process improvements. So to do this, you're going to really have to rely on your internal experts, right? And it's really, these experts are going to help you understand all the ins and outs of your critical business processes. That's going to enable you when you're in front of your leadership team to articulate what are the critical business issues that are holding back EHS performance, and then how specifically will digital transformation resolve those issues? And as you can imagine, you're going to be question pretty heavily on why this investment is needed. So it's necessary to arm yourself with the information that's necessary so you can, you know, state quite clearly and unequivocally why now is an appropriate time for this type of investment. So when we talk to clients, we always recommend, you know, three key things to do when you're identifying your process improvements. The first thing is look for opportunities to simplify workflows. So anywhere that you can remove steps, remove time, remove effort, remove cost, that's going to be certainly a gain to the business. And it's going to enable you to really articulate that effect of maximizing productivity versus cost and even reducing errors and waste that are in your business. The second thing that you want to be mindful of is avoid the mistake of trying to fix things that aren't broken or trying to fix everything all at once. So really what you want to do here is focus on your critical issues that are known, and I would say that are easily explained. If you can't explain it in 30 seconds or less, it's probably too complex and you're probably going to lose people as to why you really need a digital solution to fix it. So do your homework, really try to understand what needs to be fixed. And I always kind of break it down into three things. Think about the activities that you're required to do either by permit or by regulation. Focus on the activities that aren't necessarily required by permit, as an example, but would enhance your corporate reputation, would enhance, you know, your social license to operate, things of that nature. And then also consider those activities that you're not necessarily required to do. They're not aligned to your general business objectives. And what you certainly want to do is probably emphasize the first two and stay away from the third. And that really ensures that you're focusing on the most important things within that framework of why a digital solution is important. And then I would say as the last point is attempt to align those, you know, your EHS digital transformation to current business goals. So, you know, this is where we're talking about simplifying processes, improves efficiency, and reduces costs. It enables us to allocate our resources differently to tackle better, you know, more pertinent critical tasks. And that's hopefully going to have a bottom line impact later on for the business and align with goals. So, you know, probably the simplest example I can give you is, you know, doing this will enable us to save cost here, but also redirect our resources to reduce the potential for injury that'll have an impact on regulatory citations potentially or compensation and healthcare costs. Your second step that you want to consider when making your business case is secure your stakeholder buy-in. So you're going to want to really sell your vision to those key stakeholders to ensure that you have their buy-in. That's really going to make a difference whether you're going to have a successful project or not. So what I've done here is just highlight a couple of those key stakeholders that I see that you should be talking to as part of that project, and certainly starting with your senior leadership team. Highly advisable that you identify that executive sponsor and you bring that person on board. Very important you sell that idea there. That executive sponsor is going to be critical to help advocate the project to the rest of the executive management team, to push for budgets and resources, to fast track approvals. It's really that individual that you really need to focus on. If you get that person on board, it's certainly going to help push the project along. Colleagues and end users, don't forget about this group. You know, since they're the ones that are going to be most impacted by, you know, these changes and will hopefully benefit from the transformation the most, you want to spend a lot of time with these individuals, again, discussing your vision, showing them how, you know, the future is going to be brighter, how their lives are going to be better. Because if we get those people on board, they in turn become additional advocates for the project. So certainly, pulling individuals together in cross-functional teams where we, you know, to identify some of those critical processes that we had talked about in the previous step, that's where you're going to start to solicit and secure that engagement of those key end users. Third group you're going to want to consider is your IT department. I read a study recently that said that about 75% of IT departments are involved in the selection of health and safety software. So certainly get those individuals involved. They have a lot of expertise, but most importantly, if you bring this request up to your senior leadership team for an investment in health and safety software, they're probably going to ask you first, can you do it in-house? And you're going to want to check that off. If you can do it in-house, great. if you can't, you want to be able to say that you've gone through, you've assessed that with your IT experts, and you've proved that that can happen. And then finally, with respect to consultants, depending on the situation, you may want to consider an external partner that's going to provide a degree of impartiality and strengthen your business case. What I would say is, consultants bring a lot of that real world experience with successful and hopefully successful software implementation projects. And they have access to a lot of those use cases and case studies that will help strengthen a lot of your arguments that you're going to need to not only solicit that buy-in from those key stakeholder groups, but that's also going to be helpful in building those quantitative cost gains and value gains that we'll talk about in a minute. So as a third step in building that business case, you're going to want to really calculate your cost savings, right? Like, let's be honest, many of these projects come down to one thing, and that's cost. And you're going to need to be able to demonstrate how this digital transformation is going to create those expected benefits on the bottom line. And so there's no one way to do this. What I tend to focus on is kind of four ideas. The first being, emphasize those efficiency gains. So back to what we had talked about before, look for those opportunities where you can remove steps, remove time, remove effort, and then try to quantify that on a dollar perspective. And that will help to solidify and make real and objective those estimates to say, by doing this, not only will we save this much money, but it will help in that payback calculation that's going to be important to solicit that buy-in from the senior level. Show the impact on compliance, right? And probably the easiest way that I would say you can do this is, if you have access to it, pull a 3 to 5 year history of your regulatory fines and associated legal costs, and compare that to what you would estimate the project, the software implementation project to be worth, and really calculate your buyback period. And certainly, for me, if anything is under 12 to 18 months, it's probably positive enough that you can probably make a very compelling argument. In addition to that, look at your external costs. Like, I think there's a general trend that we're seeing where businesses are and health and safety departments are streamlining. Certainly we're becoming and seeing more generalists within health and safety departments, and we're outsourcing more of those specialist functions. So, look at those external costs and say, are there things that we outsource right now that we have to because we don't have the time or we don't have the resources or the capacity to deal with it? And does implementing a software project or a digital transformation, does that enable us to upload and avoid those external costs? And that could be something that's particularly useful. And then, as a last point, leverage those case studies. Again, whether those are internal to you through a partnership or with any of the vendors that you're talking to, many of them have really compelling case studies that certainly if there's another business within your industry segment or with unique business challenges that reflect your own, that you can show a very positive story after this kind of digital transformation, it's certainly going to help build that business case as well. So just as a final thought, I just wanted to leave you with five quick ideas to think about when you want to pick or you're considering moving toward a digital transformation and trying to pick a vendor or a partner that you want to work with. So the first is find the right software function fit. And what I mean by this is don't just consider what you need now. Consider how your business is going to grow, what you might need in terms of capabilities in the future, and really try to assess, does the partner that I'm working with, do they have the scalability of their solution to be able to accommodate how my business needs to grow? The second point is really consider, who you're talking to. Is it an EHS expert or is it a software expert? And they both provide advantages. It's always nice for an EHS professional to be able to talk to somebody on the other side of that conversation who's walked a mile in their shoes and certainly is going to help them make that compelling argument to their business of this is why that digital transformation is so important. Reduce your deployment and adoption risk. This really, is saying, focus on those partners that have a demonstrated track record of success, right? In terms of software adoption, there's a lot of software projects that get initiated every year. A lot of them fail. You really want to focus your attention on the ones that, that have that demonstrated track record. Fourth, assess the roadmap. What I mean by this, and it's sort of related to the first point, but what I mean by this is consider where the organization is looking, right? Like, where is that software vendor looking? Are they anticipating some of the problems that are 1 to 2 to 5 years down the road? Are they working on solutions? Because you really want to get that degree of vision and forward-looking perspective, because that's going to certainly be an advantage to you moving forward. And then finally, you know, we say understand the company you keep matters. This is really about, you want a partner, right? You want somebody that's going to be there the whole, you know, every step of the way through the implementation, some of the learning curve. So make sure that you find somebody that you can work with, that you feel confident with, and you have that degree of trust. It's particularly important. So that really brings us to the end of my presentation. Before I hand it back over to Benita to start the Q&A, I just wanted to advise everyone, if you're interested to learn more, we do have a number of really great resources available here at Qordi that you can certainly check out if you'd like to. You know, our website is on the screen if you'd like to jot that down, or certainly reach out to us, and we'd love to have a conversation to see how we can help you guys with any sort of transformation, digital transformation you're looking for. So with that, I'll flip it back to you, Benita.
Thank you, Sean, for a great presentation. So before we have our presenter address some questions that have been submitted throughout the program, I want to remind you that we would love your feedback in our webinar survey to help improve our programs. So now let's begin our first question. What is the biggest mistake companies make when selecting EHS software?
Biggest mistake, that's pretty, so what I would say in terms of the biggest mistake, I would say is they, again, it kind of goes back to the three points that I was mentioning earlier, is that they don't define what are those critical business issues to start with, and they don't create that compelling business case. And what the reason I say that is, in some cases you start to see scope creep, right? So as you start to talk about your needs, you start to uncover that there's other needs that could be potentially resolved within your digital transformation project, and you don't necessarily have the budget for it. So you've gone through this process of trying to define those critical needs. You've submitted that, you've attained a budget, and then when you're starting to select your vendor and look at the capabilities available, you suddenly learn something, and then you don't necessarily have the wiggle room that you need. So this is where I think as you're going through and you're trying to create or identify those critical business issues, is you know, reach out to a lot of these vendors. They're very interested in helping kind of define and link you with a lot of ideas and emerging emerging, you know, thought leadership pieces that might inform what you really need, and that's going to help you build a list of the right business issues that you need to address, and that's going to ensure that you have the right budget to implement the program that you need.
Great, thank you. Next question: many companies are in cost-cutting mode to stay afloat during the pandemic. So how would you convince a leadership team focused on cutting costs that now is the time for software or technology investment?
Yeah, that's a difficult one. again, it's part of going back and doing your homework and really trying to understand, like, unfortunately, a lot of businesses, and for a lot of good reasons, they're focused on kind of, you know, staying afloat in you know, the current months and in a couple months leading forward. But I think this is where you need to have a little bit broader perspective, and you have to start creating that vision of potentially, not only, you know, through this technology, here's how we're going to resolve a lot of health and safety issues, but again, it's here's how we're going to resolve how resolution of these issues has a very tangible financial bottom line impact. And I think if you do that and you do it well, hopefully we get to a position where there's some offsets. And I always kind of think it akin to, you know, when the market is down, if you're interested in buying stocks, you know, when the market is down, everybody want, you know, and the economy slows, everybody wants to hold on to their money, when really that's really where to, you know, people would argue that's where you'd want to invest. It's kind of that same approach. It's might be a little bit painful in the short term, but when things kick back over and you start to really realize the gains that are achievable through digital transformation, you might find yourself that much further ahead. So I would say keep a longer term focus. I think that's probably where a lot of people lose a little bit and start to be challenged with some of those short term perspectives.
Great, thank you. And that is all the time we have today. Please join me in thanking Sean for his presentation, as well as our sponsor, Cordy. If you have any additional questions or comments, please don't hesitate to click the email ask button on the console. Please visit webinars.ishn.com for the archive of this presentation, as well as information about our upcoming events. We appreciate your time and hope you have found this webinar to be a valuable experience.